Welcome back to Cinema D'Amore. I am Justin Morgan. I'm here with
Jeff Phillips.
We are concluding our Coen Brothers theme with their 2010 Western True Grit, which happens to fall between A Serious Man and Inside Llewyn Davis. For New Year's Eve, we decided to end the year with the Hudsucker Proxy, and then we rolled into our Coen Brothers theme completely. We've previously covered Barton Fink from 1991, The Big Lebowski from 1998, and No Country for Old Men from 2007, and we will continue to do directors for the unforeseeable future. Unfortunately, we were only able to cover 5 Coen Brother films, and when we move into our next director, we'll only be able to cover 4 of his. Imagine it as a sampling of these directors. We're not necessarily doing the greatest hits. It's not always their best. It's not always their worst. We're just giving you a variety. It would be nice to be able to cover a director or a set of directors completely through their filmography, but it would have to be a year-long project, and we like to mix things up, so that necessarily will not be happening on our show. I guess we should begin with Proverbs 28:1, right? The wicked flee when the nun pursueth.
It's a good one.
That's how the film starts.
It's a good way to start. Get right in there.
Every film should begin with a quote or a Bible verse.
Yeah. It feels very Coen Brothers throwing that in there.
Yeah, especially because the film right before this, A Serious Man, was all about religion.
Yeah, they do like to go back and forth, and we've discussed before, they like to switch up their styles and the genres they go into. This is
I think this was a Western.
I didn't think it was, but yeah, I could be wrong. Other than, they did Buster Scruggs later, but their first full-on Western. They've had the Western aspects, and obviously No Country for Old Men is a good neo-Western, adding noir elements in there to something like that. Here they just go straight up Western.
It reminds me a little bit of Quentin Tarantino's career, where he had been shooting Westerns forever, but then Django Unchained is his first Western set around the Civil War.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what this is, because No Country for Old Men is 100% a Western, but even Fargo has Western element. Even Blood Simple has Western elements. So yeah. It goes all the way back to that.
I was about to say, yeah, Blood Simple has that. Even something like Raising Arizona, like it feels like a Western. It's out in the desert, has those strange characters out there, kind of like a lawless atmosphere.
The Coen brothers don't like to call it a remake. They are saying that they based it off of the book.
Yeah, they say it's more of a reimagining.
I don't know how to explain that. I remember when Charlie and the Chocolate Factory came out. Oh, it's based on the book more than the movie. Well, the movie was somewhat based on the book, too. Yeah.
But I know what they're saying is, I think almost it's not a problem, but to say that their version isn't a remake is that so much of the original movie is very, very faithful to the book to begin with. So to say, oh, we're just also doing the book. Yeah, not that much is very different. Almost other than the end. The end is almost the only thing in both of these movies that plays out any differently at all. I will say, I watched the original True Grit for the first time yesterday. Even before this one came out, I never got around to watching it. It's funny that that's the movie that John Wayne got an Oscar for.
It's his only Oscar.
I wouldn't even say it's his best. It was later in his career. It was getting closer to his old age. It felt like another one of those where the Academy Award likes to give out awards when they know someone's getting older and like isn't really going to do anything that they're going to give you an award for, so they feel like, oh well, you've been in film for so long and we've never given you an Oscar, so we'll give you one now, even though this isn't really your best movie. You've made other better ones with John Ford. And Jesus Christ, I thought it was decent. I read the book before. There's a reason why the dialogue is hardly changed at all between the two films. Even the Coens didn't even really go in and change the dialogue. It is really well written, even in the original book, like some of those great lines, like, I typically go backwards when I'm backing up, like stuff like that, that the original author Charles Portis had already written.
Charles Portis wrote a book in 1968. Henry Hathaway filmed that movie within the next year,
in 69, yeah.
So it came out in 69, 41 years later. Coen Brothers adapt this again. Right off the bat, it is kind of like a mindfuck. I rewatched the original, too. It's on Hulu, if anyone has Hulu and wants to watch it.
And Paramount Plus. That's how I watched it.
It's
all over the place.
First time I had seen it was actually after watching the Coen Brothers in theater. So probably early 2011. And it's such a mindfuck watching them back to back because I have not read the book. But the plot essentially is exactly the same, where this girl's father was killed by this piece of shit gambler.
Yeah.
And she tries to like take matters into her own hands by hiring somebody to help track and capture him. And the person that she chooses to go with is the one that is basically described as the meanest or the one with grit. I like how when they go through the three options of people that there are, the one's like, he's a good man. He really thinks about the situation. And
yeah, the other one's the like, best he does tracker.
What's right. Other one's a great tracker. But like Chuck said, most of the beats are exactly the same. Scenes change. There's a lot of dialogue that is in the original movie that makes it into the remake, or the Coens, I guess, if we're not going to call it a remake, that is actually said by like different characters or at different points in the movie. So I kind of really wish that I had read the book before we did this episode more recently, so it was in my mind.
Yeah.
Comparing the 1969 True Grit to the 2010 True Grit, there's a line when Rooster is talking to LaBeouf where they mention a captain, and the character says, a captain of what? The lines are switched from the 1969 version to the 2010 version. And it's kind of weird how there's a lot of moments in the original film that don't make it to the Coen brothers because you don't need to see it.
Yeah, there's a lot less in like the beginning in the town.
I feel like almost every choice, and this is maybe a little bit unfair, but kind of the way I feel remakes should make. All their choices are better, I think, than the original movie. Everything just works more naturally, I feel, including the ending, but I guess we'll get to the ending when we get there. I thought that, for example, the scene where they come across the cabin for the first time, and the Coens, they decide to do it at night, and they are not with the LaBeouf character at that moment. When they finally get the upper hand on these people that are about to give out their secrets, and this horrific scene kind of goes down, they find out that this Ned Pepper gang, I guess I should jump back, Jeff Bridges, Rooster Cogburn, Haley Steinfeld's Maddie, and Matt Damon's LaBeouf are all looking for Josh Brolin's Tom Chaney, because Tom Chaney is the character that murdered Maddie's father in cold blood. Rooster, Maddie, and LaBeouf believe that Tom Chaney is with this Ned Pepper and the Ned Pepper gang. And these characters reveal like, oh, they're actually going to be coming here tonight. And it's so much more dramatic when they're there at night as opposed to when they're there in broad daylight.
Yeah.
Then the scene elevates literally when Rooster Cogburn and Maddie go up on the hill and they're just kind of like wait for them to show up. And I love that moment of them thinking that they're like, this doesn't make any sense. Why did they send the scout ahead? And then they realize that it's LaBeouf. It almost kind of mirrors the original Back to the Future. Well, at the end when he's like watching the scene from the top of the hill and you just kind of know what's going to go down.
That damn LaBeouf.
I don't know. Their comedy is great too. LaBeouf gets shot and he's 100% sure that it was Rooster that shot him. And Rooster's like, no, there's no way I shot you. So they have this whole scene where they're throwing the cornmeal and proving that he's a good shot, which he kind of proves that he's a terrible shot. And that he most likely did shoot Matt Damon's character. I'm pretty sure this is the only movie that Matt Damon did for the Coen brothers.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it is. I think he's...
If it was a Soderbergh film, it would be like film 100.
Yeah, that's his guy. He got with the Coens one time. Yeah, we get Josh Brolin and Jeff Bridges back in this one, which I enjoy the way that they both... Jeff Bridges kind of, I think I said it when we were doing the Big Lebowski episode, this does feel like continuing if the dude randomly was back in the Old West. He's kind of that same like goofy character, but he's still like kind of the, you know, he's not an idiot. He's not stupid. He just knows, you know, he enjoys a cocktail every once in a while, enjoys a stiff drink while he's out doing his work. But Josh Brolin's great as just the exact opposite of his character from No Country for Old Men. He really is kind of like, he's such a goofy, weird guy.
I love how they bring it up.
He dallied in Monroe, Louisiana and Pine Bluff, Arkansas, before turning up at your father's place.
Well, why did you not catch him in Pine Bluff, Arkansas or Monroe, Louisiana?
He is a crafty one.
I thought him slow-witted myself.
That was his act.
It was a good one. Are you some kind of law?
That's right. I'm a Texas Ranger.
So it is a great moment when you don't see the character at all until 2/3 of the way through them. Almost the final act is like pretty much when you're seeing this character. And he is the dumbest character that you could possibly have. It's his dialect.
Yeah, the way he talks. He just has that, that speech pattern. Oh, hey, guys. And he's like, yeah, I know you. And she's like pulling out that gun. And he's like, what are you going to do?
I know you. Your name is Maddie, but you're little Maddie the bookkeeper. Isn't that something?
Yes, and I know you, Tom Chaney.
What are you doing out here?
Came to fetch some water.
Oh, man, what are you doing in these mountains here?
Well, I have not been formally deputized, but I'm acting as an agent for Marshal Reuben Cochran in Judge Parker's court. I have come to take you back to Fort Smith.
Well, I will not go. How do you like that?
There's a posse of officers up there who will force you to go.
Well, that is interesting news. And how many is up there?
Right around 50. And they're all well-armed and they mean business. What I want you to do now is come on across the creek and walk in front of me up that hill.
I think I will oblige the officers to come after me.
Well, if you refuse to go, I'll have to shoot you.
Oh. Well, then you had better cock your piece. All the way back. Don't lock.
I know how to do it. You will not go with me?
No, it's just the other way around. You're going with me.
I don't think so.
You're doing a good impersonation.
I know, yeah. I love his performance in this. He's so
I liked him, though, a lot better than the original character, too, in the original movie. He felt like that dim-witted character that thought that everybody was out to get him.
Yeah.
And that Maddie's father was in on ripping him off of his money that he lost gambling. And then the scene that you actually see play out in the original is weird because, I mean, I guess you could take him for a drunk when he shoots her dad. But when you meet him at the end of the movie, he doesn't seem that stupid.
No, he just seems like an asshole. He 100% seems like he killed him on purpose.
Yeah, so I like the idea that he just wasn't, did not have a high IQ level.
Yeah,
And it's a good moment, too, when she's finally talking to Ned Pepper, and she's kind of describing why she's after this guy and what he's done. And it almost feels like you really get those shades of gray, where, like, you know that he's the leader of this gang, but he seems to have sympathy for the situation. He seems to somewhat agree with her.
Yeah, yeah.
And I only say somewhat because he still leaves her with him.
Yeah, he's... I think that's generally one of the biggest improvements between the original and this one, which I do think the original is still good. And part of that, I think, is just because the source material is good and they didn't really have to do too much to do it. They more or less just filmed it straight up other than adding a couple things here and there and extending some things that are different. But like, I enjoy John Wayne in a lot of movies, but I don't think this particularly suits him too much to do comedy. It's definitely not his main thing. He's definitely better when he is just being the serious, like, shoot first, ask questions later, like, tough guy that he plays in most of his other films.
I feel like this was a good role for him.
I don't think it's bad, but I don't think it's his best.
I like the role. I think that maybe it's, like, the most different from what he's
I think that's what helps it stand out. I don't necessarily think it's, like I said, I don't think it's better than his other roles. Like, I think his best is probably The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance. Probably my favorite John Ford film and my favorite of John Wayne's films.
Damn.
Which
they are pretty much hand in hand with most of their movies.
But that's another good, basically a Western noir practically. I think he works pretty well in that movie. And I think the girl, Kim Darby, that plays Maddie is good in that. Glenn Gamble, I think, is just okay, and most of the rest of the cast, other than Robert Duvall and Dennis Hopper are fine. They're both in smaller roles.
Yeah, I mean,
roles, but...
I think it's more of, you know that they're good actors, and you didn't really get to see those performances in these movies, because I was like, oh yeah, Dennis Hopper, and then Dennis Hopper's dead.
Yeah.
And then Robert Duvall, after this, goes on to do, like, the Godfather movies. But in this, he's like, I don't know, he just seemed out of it or something.
They said
I'm surprised he became the level of actor that he had.
Cause... Yeah. I was reading some, like, getting some backstory on, like, both versions, and I know they said...
Give me some backstory.
I know they said, like, Robert Duvall, I think, didn't get along with the director or John Wayne, and I don't know if it was just a different personality, just the fact that it was, like, Robert Duvall's that younger generation of actor and John Wayne's more that old school, you know, started in the 30s. You know, he's been around since like the silent era of films, and just a difference of opinion. And someone else said like Henry Hathaway, was nobody wanted to work with him because he was like a cranky old man when he was filming. He also said he didn't like Maddie's performance, Kim Darby. He's like, well, it doesn't help that she's ugly too, or something like that.
Is that how that line made it into the remake?
No, I do think that line's in the book too. I haven't read the book in a while, but I'm pretty sure that's in there too. They do say, I feel like it's more like one of those things where they would say, oh, she's very homely.
I do enjoy the line in the original though, and I don't think it's in the remake, where John Wayne is talking about how basically you're not a man if you work for a woman, and then Maddie's character is like, well, technically I hired you, and his face, yeah. That was like the best moment I think in that entire movie, because I really felt that reaction. That was a pretty good performance, because his face was just like, oh yeah. Shit, like he didn't consider that at all.
There's a lot of good moments, and again, some of them do play out almost exactly the same in the original and in this one, particularly with when Maddie first gets to town and she's like negotiating with everyone, which in both versions it plays out really funny, where it's like, you know, this 14-year-old girl that's telling everyone what to do, and like a lot of people look at her and they're like, wow, why, how is this little girl like telling me what to do, or the horse trader.
She comes off a lot more convincing in the remake.
I think that is just a difference of performance that they had her in the original. Kim Darby seems like she knows what she's talking about and she is serious, but then there's occasions where she gets like, she acts like too much of a kid or something like that. Like they let that bleed through a bit more than they do in this one. There's only a couple times in the remake, when she like starts kind of doing like kid stuff. Like she gets, she almost seems like the most childlike when she gets excited that LaBeouf made his shot at the end, and she's like jumping up and down like, woohoo, Mr. LaBeouf, you did it. Like, but for the most part,
that's almost like her. And that's actually interesting that you bring that up, because that's like her. She literally loses all her childhood within 10 minutes of that scene.
Yeah.
But yeah, I like too, how like they have the lines. If you wanted to kiss your father, it would be all right. And the Coen brothers made that performance.
It's so creepy, so much funny, like the way that, because he keeps repeating it too. The guy only says it once in the original, but the guy in the remake says it like three times or something.
Well, I think he says it twice, and then he ends with that like where she's talking about she might not have a place to stay, and he's like, if you would like to sleep in a coffin,
oh, yeah,
it would be all right.
Yeah, that was the other one that he says. Yeah, he has good moments, and I do like, she doesn't say, I agree, there are a couple lines. I enjoy in the original when they tell her, we'll be sleeping with Grandma Turner, and she just looks at the woman and says, well, I assume my rent will be half then. And that woman's like so mad that she's saying that to her. It's like, well, I assume since I have to share that my rent will be half then. Like, but then they do play it in the remake, they're really petty too,
where when she picks up her dad's like leftover stuff from the hotel, and they're like, if you wanted like a sack for a flower sack for that handgun, I would sell you one for a nickel. Like you wouldn't even give it to her. Like she'd have to buy it off.
Everyone needs to make a dime. Yeah.
Also like it's like the stock market with the horses too. She negotiates the horses and makes the stable owner like buy the horses back. And then when she needs the pony, she purchases it for $10, and he's like, well, earlier it was like $25, and
yeah,
she's like, well, earlier it was worth 25, and now it's worth 10.
They play that out really good in both versions, although I prefer in the original, where you don't see or hear from J. Noble Daggett until the very end of the film. Like it almost feels like she could be just making this guy up the entire time. Cause she always like references him when she needs to. She's like, I'll speak to my lawyer. And like I can't remember if it's LaBeouf or Cogburn in the original. It's like, she wields that lawyer like a knife or something like that. And we don't see it till the end. And it's like support when John Wayne actually meets him. He's like, oh, it's J. Noble Daggett. I've heard so like in the flesh, like he's surprised that that's actually a real person. Like she thought he was just making that up the entire time.
I kind of like that you don't see it in the Coen brothers, because I kind of like, yeah, I but you hear prefer the idea that she's smart enough to make
the voiceover of her thing, which I feel like gives it away. Like Like I enjoy that they put J.K. Simmons as that character, just doing the voiceover narration, but it like breaks it a little bit, because then it's like, okay, you know, she got that letter from somewhere. Like, we don't see it, but you do hear that narration, which I feel like if she'd have just shown up with it and been like, this is from my lawyer or something like that. Like, I like in the original when she just has it in her hand already, she's just like, here you go. And that guy's like, oh, you had that ready to go. Like, you already had that pre-made.
Yeah.
He's so mad when she like tricks him like that. So that's another like small detail.
Well,
that
I enjoy too, like the little differences of like what you have to see and what you don't have to see. I enjoy that the introduction to Rooster is while he's giving his testimony in court, as opposed to that like brief little occurrence that she had with him outside, like trying to like track him to that place that he was staying.
That's not his first appearance.
He is doing
his business.
Oh yeah, but we don't see him, do we?
But you hear him talking to her, but I enjoy that introduction better. That she's like knocking on the door, and he just keeps going, it's occupied and will be for some time, and he just keeps saying that to her.
Yeah, how did you find me? Well, I went to this tavern, but then they told me you were back out. They sent me out here to find you.
He just keeps going. This premises will be occupied for some time.
I guess what I really like probably more than anything is it comes down to the shots. It comes down to the cinematography. It's just light years ahead of the original. And I just love that it stays in her perspective. And even the way that he's lit in that courthouse before she moves up close, he's almost a silhouette. Like he's almost lit kind of from behind, so you can't see him. And I always enjoyed that, where it's like you get his voice and she's kind of has to like get her small body like through the crowd, like around all these guys to see what was going on. And yeah, then you have that awesome line where they're like asking him if which direction he went. And he's like, usually when I go backwards, I'm going back.
Yeah, that's a good moment of kind of.
I like, when did this, how did the, you said that he was over here when you shot him, but we found him right here with his arm in the fire.
No, yeah, maybe the hogs moved
him. Like, did you move him? Yeah, he's like, I don't know. The hogs moved him. Maybe I moved him. I don't remember.
that's another moment that kind of goes with, like, No Country for Old Men of his character is one of those, like, it's clear that his type is dying out. Everyone's, like, even the fact that the defendant has a lawyer that's trying to make this case for this guy that's in all likelihood probably a murderer. And trying to like make the U.S. Marshal look bad. It really feels like that's another one of those moments of he can see that his time is going out, and he even like references that later, and they mention it in the original film, like oh, now all of a sudden all these criminals have rights. I can't just go up and shoot them when I know they're guilty. Like, oh, I can't believe I have to actually like arrest them and bring them into court and treat them with respect. Like He's a dying breed. This is his final ride while he's still able to do this.
Yeah, I mean, I like all the character arcs in this too. I really enjoy his like last hurrah is essentially what it is. And he's kind of given up in life to a point, and this kind of like reinvigorates him.
Yeah.
He does have like, it's weird because you brought up the Big Lebowski. And he does have a lot of Lebowski-isms, but he also feels completely different. I feel like the biggest commonality between them is how comfortable they are with who they are. They're like 100% all right saying their thoughts and feelings and doing whatever they need to do. The dude has less purpose, though, and I feel that Rooster Cogburn doesn't want to like kind of share his like goals, his dreams or whatever. And like things like I've noticed from the two movies is he seems to be more of a drunk like throughout the original, and he kind of sobers up over the course of the journey. Like they have that moment where John Wayne falls off his horse and he's like an idiot. Actually, I think he falls off his horse like three times probably. Yeah. And I don't remember Jeff Bridges like I think maybe there's one thing where he like stumbles off his horse, but he was like pretty much together. And he was like okay to do his tracking and everything throughout the movie. I also liked, if you want to say something I liked more in the original than I did in the Coen brothers, I really enjoyed when Maddie realized that Rooster Cogburn had already taken off, and when she is trying to get to him. I don't necessarily like in the original how they're already on the same side of the lake or the river or whatever. But I love how she escapes from that guy in the original where she, like, backhands him with his fucking hat, with her hat. Something about it is, like, so much funnier and kind of more violent than the apple thing. The Coens did a great plant and payoff, though. They did, like, with everything. That it happens so many times in this movie. They talk about LaBeouf's telling his story about how he shot something from, you know, 300 yards. Or no, he missed his shot from 300 yards. And they're like, you could never make a shot that far. So that comes back into play. And then Rooster's talking about how he took on 7 other people at once on horseback. And they're like, oh, that can't happen. They bring up the apple thing's shorter. Where it's like, what do horses eat? Apples. Then she steals the apples, and then she uses the apples to hit, you know, take out that one guy. And then like the softer plant would have to be like the snakes. I think it works way better in the Coen brother film, where they're putting like the rope around them to like kind of like scare off snakes, and that's all you hear about them. As opposed to the original film where they like make a point to be like, that's a snake. There's snakes down there. So you don't want to fall down that hole, or I'll throw you down that hole. So the Coens kind of like, I don't know, works so much better. I think it plays out so much better cinematically for kind of the same situation going down.
Yeah.
I'm holding off on that. We can get to that at the very end. But yeah.
Again, like,
it works a lot better with the Coen brothers.
Yeah, like I said, I do enjoy the casting. I think Matt Damon does work better as LaBeouf. Obviously, I mean, Glenn Campbell was not a trained actor. He was a singer that, you know, popped up. That was like a weird thing later in John Wayne's career, where like every one of his movies had randomly some singer in it or something like that. He had Ricky Nelson in, I can't think of which one he's in. I know Dean Martin's in Rio Bravo, and then Glenn Campbell's in this. Like they would just randomly pair him with singers all the time in those movies in the 60s. They kept adding that to it. So that they can sing the theme song as well, which, I mean, you know, this movie would have been better if Matt Damon were singing about True Grit over the credits. You know, it might have improved it.
No, I don't think I listened to all the credits, but it definitely needed to end on that Leaning on Everlasting Arms song.
Yeah.
Because it's so fucking funny. Like it's definitely a nod towards what happens to Maddie, which we'll get into. But I just think that it's like, is it funny? And they use it like earlier. They use like the music that's from Night of the Hunter. It's the same Everlasting Arms tune, and the cinematography kind of looks the same too, because it's like that dusk. I mean, it's more like the lighting than obviously the color, because there wasn't color in it. But yeah, I don't know. For some reason, it's more of a sense of humor thing to me. And there's clearly sense of humor in this too, because remember when we saw it and there was all that controversy? Well, not really controversy. But everybody was like, what the fuck was that credit for Buster Coen playing Matt Damon's ab double?
Which we never see Matt Damon with a shirt off.
Yeah, they said that's Ethan's son. Yeah. And he worked like a production assistant, and he wanted a better sounding title. So that's what that's the one that which, they yeah, gave that, him. But it is funny. Like Matt Damon's ab double is it almost feels like a Jimmy Kimmel thing.
Something
like a joke. It's some weird, like a weird joke, because like you think about it and you're like, I don't think he ever had a shirt off. It's hilarious. It is funny.
So yeah, I do enjoy they throw their kind of like strange sense of humor into this, and it's all in like really small moments. There's no major like big scene that's like laugh out loud funny, but it's just all those small moments.
Yeah, there is.
I enjoy when, yeah, I think I know what you're talking about, but I like when he just like kicks those kids off the porch, like repeatedly, Rooster Cogburn, and keeps like knocking those kids when they're like poking that donkey and like hitting it with sticks and stuff. So he like throws the one kid off, and then as he's walking by, he kicks the other one off with the back of his.
Yeah, you like that hudsucker slapstick.
I enjoy when they throw that in there. And then like as he's coming back out, he kicks that kid off the porch one more time as he's going out. And yeah, of course, who can forget the Bear Man from. That just makes me think, now that I watch it, it makes me think of Midsummer when he comes up with that bear skin. You're not LaBeef.
That's the funniest moment, though. It's not the guy in the bear suit. It's like he walks all the way up to him. And then it's on Jeff Bridges for like a little too long.
As he's waiting,
just like confused.
Yeah.
Like, you're not LaBeef.
That was one of those lines that almost like if I could go back and watch this movie again for the first time and have it erased from my mind, because it's like, it's still a funny line every time I see it. But that first time that I watched it in theaters and just like, that guy rolls up and in the edge, the way he says, "You're not LaBeef." I couldn't stop laughing from that moment. It was just like too funny of just that random guy.
The only thing I had read was that I guess the scene where they find the body and Maddie climbs up the tree to cut the body down, that wasn't in a book either.
Yeah, that's
so that was like an entirely added scene. And the one thing I was reading, I kind of like the interpretation of it, where basically after she cuts the body down, this guy comes like by, and Jeff Bridges is, you know, selling him the body for whatever he can get from it. And the article was kind of like, you know, she's so high up, like she has the moral high ground at that point, that she's like not even visible. Yeah. You know, it's like as if she's not even there. And I feel like that is something like the Coens would have intended, because they do really think these things out. There's probably so many references in here, because I see it in everything. But I saw, like, you know, there's another Searchers reference, where they isolate that, you know, they kind of direct your eyes to look at the doorway. And in this case, it was a cave.
Yeah.
But I think I've seen it in everything. It's in so many movies. It's like, that's like the shot that everybody pulls off.
Yeah. I do like the bear guy too. Like he has another like weird thing where he tells him he's a dentist and a doctor, and that he's out in the woods performing, you know, medicine. And then when he says like, "Oh yeah, I got this body off of that guy." And then he goes, "I took the teeth, but I'll sell it to you if you want it for anything else." Like just the implication of what else you would want a body for that doesn't have teeth anymore.
Yeah. I mean, I was a little surprised, like, I think I misinterpreted that scene to begin with, because I thought when he said, "Oh, the body might be worth something," I was thinking it might be worth something to a bounty hunter, because
I took it the same way too.
It could be somebody that's worth money, like a reward, dead or alive. Not that he was going to sell him, and there's going to be somebody that's like, "I do dentistry, so like I collected this guy's teeth in case, like, I don't even know how you would replace teeth." I'm assuming that he's using the teeth.
You could probably like
replace
dentures,
other people's teeth.
Like you would take his teeth and then like make dentures, maybe.
There's something in that field that, like, it wasn't like a creepy teeth collecting thing. It was more like, people's teeth suck and I'm here to fix it. Because like some of their teeth, who's the guy that played Ned Pepper that was
Barry
in
Pepper.
Barry Pepper. I don't know. That's great casting. I really like him too. He's the only thing, he's in a couple things. Like I remember him from Green Mile, but he has like that perfect like Western twang and persona to him. Like his big fucking like wool sheep chaps that he wears. Yeah. Like, they're, like, ridiculous. Coens love doing shit like that, too.
Yeah, there's a thing I was reading too that was just like a random fact about like different actors, and it was that like Barry Pepper likes making what he calls like artifacts for his characters. So they said like the knife that he has in this movie he handmade because he has his own blacksmith forge and likes he just is into making knives and random stuff like that. And he said like for all of his characters that he plays, he like makes something like homemade at his house that he can have on his character to make it feel more real for him.
He needs more westerns because like that rustic, gonna be able to easier. Use that? Like, I hope he's like in some sci-fi movie and he's got to make something like really futuristic looking.
Yeah, figure out what to put in there. That's why he never does. Like someone's like, why doesn't Barry Pepper ever do sci-fi? It's like he can't make anything for sci-fi. He refuses to do it because he can't make his own prop.
Makes a future blade, yeah. And they're like, there's no blades in the future.
He probably, because I don't even think he ever even really has the knife out, so it's probably, I think it is just something that he probably has on him that just makes it like it's in the costume, like he doesn't even have to use it.
You know what, like, I didn't even realize that his name was Barry Pepper. I don't think I ever knew, like, I couldn't name that actor if I saw him. It would just be, oh, he's in the Green Mile.
Well, 100%, he's in Saving Private Ryan.
Yeah, Saving Private Ryan's that's his probably biggest.
Thing, probably. Like, that's the thing that most people would recognize him immediately from.
So he's in these, yeah, he's in all these movies, and then he gets the perfect role as Ned Pepper for the Ned Pepper gang.
Yeah.
I wonder if the Coens just, like, I mean, I think he's a good actor, and I definitely, like, I like him better than Robert Duvall in the original. I wonder if the Coens, like, hired him based on name. It just, I don't know, something about it just seems a little too perfect.
Yeah, and I like both of these movies. Like, the original version is rated PG, despite the fact that it starts with a guy getting shot, people getting hanged, a guy getting his fingers cut off. Like, you know, we can't really see it because they didn't go all out for the effects. But for a movie rated PG, it is very violent for an old Western. And then in this version's not rated R, rated PG-13, despite that we watch a guy's fingers get chopped off, and then the guy that chopped his fingers off gets shot right in the face, and it does not even cut away from him getting shot in the face and blood spraying on.
Hey, and this movie pulled off Jeff the Rudy. Classic. I forgot, like, you know where you watch an older movie, and then now there's a bigger star? Domhnall Gleeson, like...
Oh, yeah, as the moon...
In 2010, and I didn't know who he was. They're
keeping
at all.
Up that tradition of,
I mean, I think he was in Harry Potter, right? I might have recognized him from that.
Yeah,
but
he's one of the.
I didn't know his name.
Which they worked with.
He's the old.
They worked
Weasley.
With another
he's like the
another Gleason. I finally got around to watching Macbeth. They worked with his father in Macbeth. Well, Joel Coen did at least, and then they had Dudley as his son. They're really piling it on there.
Yeah, that kid bothers me.
He has a weird face.
Definitely his face. They are making fun of it in The Queen's Gambit. Did you watch The Queen's Gambit? It's got that Anya Joy Taylor.
Oh, yeah, I've seen the picture that's like his eyes are too close together and her eyes are too far apart.
Yeah,
I've seen that picture.
They're like momentarily like an item of sorts, I guess. But yeah, it's weird. Yeah. He kind of does fit really well, I think, in Tragedy of Macbeth, especially because he's like the son of royalty. So like he has that look of like he couldn't defend himself if he wanted to.
I thought we can get in on a side tangent there, but I did think that movie was fantastic. I really enjoyed, there was something like I really enjoy about the very stylized look to it. Like it very, very much like the old German, like Fritz Lang films of just the sets just
had like the
sets
universal
like go,
monsters set feel
like
to it.
It just feels like the sets, it feels like you could turn in any direction and the set would just like disappear into nothingness, like just the way it was all set up. And that was another one that I thought all the performances were great. I thought Denzel Washington and Frances McDormand were great together. Everyone was good in it. Yeah, Brendan Gleeson is the king.
The witch,
the witch was weird. I enjoyed how they played that though, of just having, just getting the one actress and just having it like especially when we first meet her and she's doing those bird-like movements. But then when she gets to the, when she gets to like the pond and they just mirror the other two underneath her, like I thought that that just visually looked really nice.
Yeah, I saw like somebody comparing it to Seventh Seal, and it does have that same look.
Yeah,
my thoughts when I when they started with her, I felt like it was Gollum. Like she has the Gollum mannerisms, like the voice and everything with the way that she was talking. Yeah. But yeah, there's so many things like I've seen on Twitter that were like, if you want to see the most beautiful dramatic or hear the most beautiful dramatic water drops of all time, they're in Tragedy of Macbeth. And then somebody was like, I like the other one that said, my favorite part of Macbeth was when they made that big soup. Which you know what I'm talking about, but nobody who has, if you haven't seen the movie, it's on Apple Plus now, so you can watch it from your home. Did you watch any other Coen brother movies? Did you get like Buster Scruggs?
I didn't
in
get
or
around
anything?
To him the way my schedule was odd. I barely got the, I barely fit in the original True Grit and then
the 69
Macbeth, which yeah, that like the Macbeth's not even, it's not even long. It's only an hour and 45 minutes. Oh. Like you can get through that, which I think I thought that before too.
You can get through anything, but yeah, you can get through that faster than.
But I guess I was thinking because I felt like it would be longer because it's like an epic story, but then it was like,
yeah.
Well, I guess those,
and it's Shakespeare.
Yeah, but most of Shakespeare's plays aren't like, they're not super long because you'd have to think like he had to write them for an audience that probably would not want to sit in like a wooden booth for more than 2 hours at a time and watch people perform. Like I think all of his stories can pretty much be done in 2 hours. Just because that's, I think, probably the allotted time that he would be working with is like writing.
Why
these plays
is Hamlet
out.
Always so long?
Well,
or King Lear, they're always long.
Know, maybe they're doing something else.
I think the other Macbeths were like, I feel like they were all within like 2 hours. Maybe that last one with Michael Fassbender was a little bit longer.
I don't think I've ever seen that one.
I didn't like it very much. It's like stylized. It looks really good. It has a really good cast, but like, I just wasn't feeling it.
Yeah.
And I felt like this, like emotionally, I was like tied to it.
Like
I really felt, I think it was Denzel Washington's best movie in a long time.
Yeah, I agree. I thought he was great. It felt like he's been preparing to play this role his whole life. Cause like you see it almost in some of his characters when they start like losing their minds, like his ranting at the end, like it made me think almost back to like Training Day when he's like at the end when he knows he's lost and he just starts like going off the rails and screaming and losing his mind. Like it really does feel like he's been preparing for a role like this. But
oh yeah, and cinematography too. I love that moment where he's going through his monologue and they're talking about the door and just the way that it's lit, it looks exactly like a dagger's like floating there in midair. Yeah, the handle ends up looking like a dagger from like that distance.
Yeah, that's,
and I was like, I just love this. This is so, this
there's
is
a,
fantastic.
There's a lot of great, the way that they did everything that comes off.
The way that they did everything was great.
the way they filmed it and did kind of like a stage production. Like it's, the sets are very minimalist. There's a lot of stuff that happens like when Brendan Gleeson comes to dinner and he's like in the courtyard, you know, monologuing while he looks through the window, and it's just those silhouettes of, you know, supposed to be like his wife and everyone enjoying the party while he's going on. And yeah, like when he's walking through and the dagger like appears in his hand and he's like, oh, what is this? This is a dagger. I didn't know I had that. Like, and yeah, he's just going off on that. And I feel like that helps in that it is very stylized, but it's stylized in a way that makes you just really focus on the performances. It's not like there's not a ton of overly detailed things in the background to distract you from, like when you watch it, no matter what the scene, yeah, Joel Coen shoots it that like you need to pay attention to everything Denzel Washington's saying. Like he's the main focus. All everything in the background you could ignore. You just have to focus on what he's saying right now.
Well, they a lot of the shots in that too. I mean, we saw it a little bit in No Country for Old Men, like that moment that I talk about where Josh Brolin looks back at his truck and literally all you can see is the truck. Like your eyes go right to that truck. A lot of Tragedy of Macbeth was exactly the same, where the way they were shooting, like, there's a lot of fog, and so the focus could only possibly be on the character that's talking. Or, like, they'll direct the light to the, like, your eyes always want to look, like, it's very specific places that they want you to look. And I think that's how every movie should be. I mean, I feel like that should be the intention, or, you know, there's something, because it's what you're showing and what you're not showing. But
I'm glad they cast Shao Kahn in this film. I thought that was a brave choice of theirs.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That random guy that I was like, why do I know that guy's face? Like, why do I, like, as soon as he popped up on screen, and I'm thinking, like, is he, like, someone, like, more famous? And I look it up, and it's the actor that played Shao Kahn, and I'm just like, man, that guy's got a really memorable face. That's all I can say about him. He is very memorable.
Yeah, and we had Stephen Root, too.
Yeah, he was great in that, too.
Which was weird, because I watched that, and then I saw his episode of Mandalorian, or sorry, I keep wanting to keep wanting to do that. His Boba Fett episode was, like, the very next one, and I'm like, now Stephen Root's going to be in everything.
He's always there. But yeah, that was, I would say definitely everyone should check that out, and I think it's, yeah, I think, I agree with you, it's probably Denzel's best movie in years, and I don't know, might even be, like, the most interesting thing, like, the thing that I've been the most excited from the Coens, or, again, since it's only one of them, but that I've been excited.
You lose Ethan and you get really excited.
Yeah, because True Grit was probably the last one that I got, like, really excited for. Like, I think there are other ones, like Llewellyn Davis that they did after, and then...
Well, even, like, Buster Scruggs wasn't advertised real well by Netflix, so...
That's probably partially...
It just was, like, they're making it, and then it kind of came out, so... I was excited. I'm just excited generally when I hear that they're making another movie. And with the tragedy of Macbeth, my first thought is, like, how many times do they have to do Macbeth? And then when they dropped that trailer and, you know, it had that classic aspect ratio and it's black and white and it was really focused and almost every shot felt, like, very, very specific. Like, they were just going through shot, like, here's a reflection shot. Here's a shot where there's the rafters. Like, every shot was like, look how beautiful this movie is. Yeah. So I wouldn't be surprised if it's up there with cinematography and possibly wins Academy Award for it.
Yeah,
but
I don't think so.
I'd like to see that probably win. I don't know if Denzel Washington has the best performance of the year, but Training Day is probably the last one that, like, I absolutely fucking loved. I mean, even Fences, he was good in Fences. Like, that always impresses me when something's, like, very dialogue heavy. So maybe that's why Tragedy of Macbeth just, like, kind of blows my mind, that they're like, we're just going to stick on this person that's is able to memorize these lines, interpret these lines, make you feel what he's trying to convey. Like, I think the hardest thing with, like, Shakespeare in the Old English is when you're reading it, you can interpret, like, it's easy to figure out what the hell they're talking about, but you kind of lose it in the dialogue. So when you have a really good actor like Denzel that's, like, delivering the lines and the emotions and everything, you're like, I get exactly what he's fucking talking about.
Yeah, I feel like that's how I get when I've read anything, or when you watch a lot of obviously there's some versions where they, like, kind of, like, tone down the dialogue or try to make it more modern for people to understand, because I think that's where you will lose people, is you generally know what they're saying, but it's like those real small references or something that was, like, a very common phrase in, you know, the 1400s or whenever these are originally written.
You don't have your English high school teacher to tell you what the interpretations of these things mean.
Back in the day, they would call these type of people this, and that's what he's referencing, and that phrase has a double meaning, and it's like, I don't understand why it does, but okay.
Yeah, they'll use this lingo that sounds, like, childish, and they're like, he's actually calling that person a slut. You're like, what? Yeah. He's implying, or, like, it's a very specific term, like, they're implying that person slept with that person's best friend. I'm like, that's what that meant? They had a word for that in the 14th century?
Almost like, and one day I feel like we should definitely cover at some point, like, different versions of Shakespeare, but, like, get into, like, some of the some of the other ones where they like either modernize it or do something different. Cause I like kind of enjoy, and I've gotten like more and more into it over the years, Romeo and Juliet, Baz Luhrmann's version, that almost kind of just like plays on the fact that some of this stuff is ridiculous. Like the dialogue, something stupid that no one even understands. Like I've seen people like to repost the scene of all the characters at like a gas station. And that guy's like, "Do you bite your thumb at me, sir?" And he's like, and they're just like playing it like it's the goofiest thing, because of course that's like not a phrase or a saying that anyone would say in modern times. But the fact that this guy just keeps going, "Yeah, I bite my thumb at you," and they just keep like referencing that, something funny like that works out. But yeah, I don't know. Like I said, that was
maybe we'll have to do like Shakespeare's. I think my favorite is still Throne of Blood, but maybe it's like too, just like slightly too different from the source material. But I think that's just Kurosawa. Like I love that style. Whoever the Coens are using now as their cinematographers, wonderful though. Keep it up.
Yeah,
keep that person. Deakins does True Grit. And I haven't looked up to see if he had done... Did he also do Llewyn Davis?
I think so.
He did a slew of them, and then I feel like he kind of fell off, and he's been snatched up.
Now he hangs out with Denis Villeneuve.
Yeah, Denis Villeneuve has him for everything now.
That's like a funny thing of how that does seem to happen sometimes, with like a particular, like whatever, like behind-the-scenes person that works with someone for a long time, and then they just switch, and it's like, yeah, it makes you wonder... Did he just like not like what they were working on at some point? Did he just decide like he didn't want to, or is he just like more excited by the prospect? Because,
or schedule wise, you just fall off. Yeah. Like every time that you're off your project, obviously that person that you're now working with is available, but maybe the person that you like working with before is taken.
I feel like my thought was that it is partially a. The last one he did with them was Hail Caesar, by the way, which we forgot to mention. Okay. Hail Caesar, I think, again. That one always like falls through the cracks when you're like, what did they do at the True Grit? And I keep forgetting Hail Caesar, but yeah. I don't...
Well, that was after Inside Llewyn Davis, even.
He didn't do Llewyn Davis. He did True Grit and then Hail Caesar.
Oh, I didn't realize you were talking specifically Roger Deakins. Sorry.
I don't know. I almost feel like it is something of, yeah, maybe wanting to do something interesting or challenging. Like the last thing he did was 1917, which obviously there definitely seems to be something of, he worked with Sam Mendes on Skyfall and Spectre. So I guess he just, you know, when he heard that idea for, one movie that looks like one giant tracking shot for 2 hours, like that's the entire film. Like obviously like sparked his interest enough that he's like, yeah, I got to go do that now.
I mean, it's been a dream of Hitchcock's for a long time to have that single-shot movie. See,
and he tried with Rope, but then Sam Mendes is just like, I'm going to blow that out of the water.
I mean, Birdman was pretty fucking close to that, too. But it's the same thing. You'd have to cheat. I would be highly, highly impressed with a single-shot film that was legit a single shot with no cuts
there,
and all the performances and everything were like, well done. Yeah, I would blow my
mind. That's where it like falls apart, is because there is one, and I think it's some Russian film, and I can never remember the name that somebody did, but it's like, I've heard people like say that, it's super interesting that it's one giant long take, but it's not that interesting of a movie because you're then immediately limited by the fact that you're stuck with this one camera and you have to set up everything in real time to do the entire film. So I think that makes me think of Hardcore Henry as being like an interesting concept, but it just doesn't work as like an actual film. Like doing an entire film from that first person perspective was I'm sure somebody was like, that'd be the coolest thing in the world. And then when you actually try to do it and people watch it and they're like, this movie's terrible. And it's like, yeah, but isn't it cool that it's all in the first person point of view? Like,
I still never watched that movie, but I think it would be kind of cool, like, if maybe you took on, like, a very heavy action sequence that was first person, and it could be, like, that's the only part in the movie, you know, like, somebody takes on, like, I don't know, I'm thinking more futuristic, where it's like, hold on, let me take over, I can fight for you, and it's like first person perspective through the whole thing. Sometimes less is better, because less makes something more exciting. It's sort of like when we were talking about our Bond movies and we were doing Quantum of Solace, I think the action sequences are wonderfully performed, but it's almost entirely an action sequence, to the point that, like, literally the best part of the movie is the end, when they're just fucking talking.
Yeah.
Like, you know, like, that's your best moment in the entire thing. And I think you kind of, like, you should, I don't understand why people don't learn from that. It's sort of, I think Abrams was the one that said it, where he was talking about, like, the reason why Jaws works as opposed to the sequels is because, you know, the best moments in Jaws, like, are all these, like, little tiny moments, like the one where he's at the dinner table with his family and he's like mimicking his kid, or his kid's mimicking him. It's things like that where you get these, like, really down to earth moments, like human moments. And then in the sequel, it's just like, oh, let's just let it all be all shark attacks.
All sharks all the time.
All sharks all the time, which it's like, in theory, you think that you want more shark, but really what you want is more tension. I mean, but I guess you also have to have good characters, because it makes me think of our Godzilla in 2014 that we also covered on our wait, no, we didn't cover it on ours, did we? Mm. I talked about it on the Three Demers podcast. I know I talked about it, so that's why I brought it up. That's actually kind of similar, because they kind of decide to be like we'll follow the human characters, and we won't show the monster. But they fucking chose a really shitty character to follow around, and it just, like, it didn't work for me. It's like, if you just gave me, like, a really good performance, a really good character, that Godzilla movie would, like, fucking blow my mind.
Yeah.
And obviously it didn't. But I mean, I think even though we're talking about it, it sounds like we're off of True Grit, but True Grit does it too. They take these moments from the original that aren't, they're like, we don't need to show it. It's not necessary. And I think that that's kind of like the best. Like, things end up becoming more of a surprise, or there's, like, a more natural build-up. Or it's like how we've said before, trust that your audience is smart enough to know what's going on, and I feel like automatically you have a better movie. You know? 2 plus 2, and the audience is like, 4. Now the audience feels smart, and they feel like they're involved in it. Yeah, their filmography, even though we covered 4 movies, I think, I can't really think, like, the bad movies are like 1. Yeah. And then everything there is like good to excellent, I think, or somewhere in between, like how we were talking about, and we should cover it at some point, The Lady Killers, because I really like The Lady Killers. I haven't watched it in a while. I remember a lot of people hating it, and I just thought that it was hilarious. Like,
yeah, it's a good one. I like it.
Well, see where it ends up
to it someday
going. But yeah, I guess, though, True Grit, like, jumping into, like, the overall story and getting to the end of the movie, you have those, like, the nice plants and payoffs that I talked about, and they all come back into play, like, at, like, everything in this third act, I think, solidifies this movie as, like, one of the greater movies that they've made. I don't know if it's still, like, statistically correct, but it was at least the movie that the Coens received, like, the most Academy Award nominations for than any of their other movies.
Still so, is, like, I mean, yeah, after that, I can't imagine. I don't think they might have got 1 or 2 for Llewellyn Davis, maybe 1 for costumes for Hail Caesar, nothing for Buster Scruggs, because it was considered, like, more TV than movie, I think. Macbeth might be able to beat it. Like,
you lose Ethan and you can do it.
You had to drop some weight there.
Yeah, but I mean, like, we finally get the introduction to Josh Brolin's character, and he's, like, so perfect playing, like, the dimwit, but you understand his motives well.
Yeah.
and you get to Ned Pepper and his character, like, you're getting just enough of everything that it everything feels satisfying. And then you finally get the two, like, face-offs with Jeff Bridges' character, where he finally gets to do the thing that he talked about. And he essentially does pull it off, but gets pinned under his dead horse, which I also prefer the dead horses in the Coen Brothers film, because I kind of thought it was funny when in the original True Grit, the horses that were supposed to be dead were definitely just laying there totally alive. Like, the face of the horse, like, it's the horse is breathing and, like, looking around, but I guess they couldn't do a better take or something, so they just, like, kept it. When they leave little Blackie in the original, it's, like, the same thing. Like, the horse's head's up, like, looking around, and they're like, we can't make it anymore. We gotta go. So he gets pinned under his horse. There's only one character, Ned Pepper, who is, like, last man technically standing, and Matt Damon makes his shot, and you get that wonderful, like, did he hit him or didn't he hit him? Yeah. He had to hit him, right? Did he not hit him? And he slumps off his horse, and that's your moment you're talking about, where Maddie gets, like, all excited that he made the shot, and then she's like, oh, that's got to be, like, 400 yards. So it's, like, better than what he could have done in the past. And then you have the great moment where he gets, like, knocked out, like, sideswiped by Josh Brolin's character, who, in the original, you see him, like, get the rock and, like, kind of make the move towards him. And I prefer the remake where he just knocks him out. She pulls the gun on him again, and when she makes that shot, like, it's exactly the same as the original, where the blast is, like, too hard and she goes back. But the remake I like because her tripping over the, like, the log makes more sense. And I like the fact that she's the one that fucking killed him. I don't like that John Wayne had to be, like, the hero that took him out in the original. Like, I don't know. I don't know if he was like, I won't be in the movie if you don't, like, let me kill the bad guy or some shit like that.
He's gotta be the hero. Yeah, that's a great moment. I do enjoy in the remake, yeah, when she starts, she's like, you made your shot. And he, like, starts, like, wanting to tell the whole, he's like, well, you know, the Sharps carbine. And then he just gets smacked in the head with a rock. It just comes out of nowhere. It's so shocking. And yeah, I enjoy it. It is a good callback to, his original line about the gun that she has. When she's like, I'm going to shoot him with it. And he's like, okay, well, I hope you find a fence post to lean on and a wall to stand behind, or a wall to lean on, so you won't blow yourself backwards. And it's feels like Christmas Story. Like, you'll shoot your eye out, like everyone telling her that. And she's like, yeah, right. And then when she actually goes to shoot it, it, like, launches her backwards.
I like the moment down in the cave too, where like, that's because the only reference you get of snakes are from earlier, like, way earlier in the movie when they're just sleeping. And it's so casual, like, that you think, oh, you know, there's not going to be any more snakes. And I just love the way that they're like in that corpse as she's trying to reach for that knife that they focus on. And I think they do a really good job of, like, not exactly showcasing the snakes at first. Like, it tears and you can kind of see the scales. And then they do the shot of them moving around. Unfortunately, they had to use CGI snakes as opposed to the original that clearly had a real rattlesnake. And I still love, like, what you're talking about, like, it's real serious. She fell down she fell down there. She gets bit. It might be on Jeff Bridges way down, or right beforehand. But he still makes that where she asks if LaBeouf's okay, and he's like, yeah, like, a rock to the head can only shut LaBeouf up for about 5 minutes. Like, he's back rambling again. But yeah, you get that beautiful moment, like, once she gets him out of, once they get them out of there, at least LaBeouf's not left for dead. And I like that he sucks the poison out of her. Like, he cuts her and he sucks it out, as opposed to, like, the original where he cuts her and then just, like, wraps her hand up. And I feel like that sucking the venom out has had to have been known back then. I doubt that it's like some new survival tactic. Because I know that we've heard about it, but I feel like how many snake bites have they probably have lived through during that period of time? You know, you're aware of them. But the remake, the Coens, I think where they nail it is at the very end of this movie, there is so much tension on the fact that this is a poisonous snake, and if we don't get her back, she's going to fucking die. As opposed to the original, where they linger. They're having conversations and shit. And it just feels so much more tense where you have, full speed on this horse that's really not supposed to be big enough for both of them, which I guess they really more so say in the original. Ride the horse to death. And then Jeff Bridges like running and carrying her, and he's got that comment about being like too fucking old, like all out of breath and stuff. But yeah, you have the moment where like it jumps to the after he's like worn out, he's kind of made it to a camp, and like you said, we know that she survives because she's doing the voiceover. Although we have had movies where voiceovers from a dead person happens in noir a lot. Just because they're narrating doesn't mean that they're alive. Yeah.
I think that's once you get to the end, that's the biggest change between the how the original works out and how the remake goes about it. And yeah, I do think the remake does it a lot better. It definitely has like that more tragic version of it. In the original, we get John Wayne takes her back and he gets the money from the lawyer, and they tell him he should go out and visit her at the farmhouse, and all she has is like, yeah, she didn't lose her arm, it's just still broken, so she just has in that sling. And yeah, when she gives a,
she doesn't seem to be affected by anything that's happened to her.
It was that bad for her. And then she says that she wants Rooster Cogburn to be, that's the weird thing is like the way they make it, it's clearly in the remake too, and it's like in the book that it's more than just a mentor relationship, that like she kind of does like fall in love with him, but it's weirder in the original that like this 14-year-old's already like, and I want to have you buried right next to me. Like it's way weirder in that, to play it in that version. Like I think it definitely, the way that it's supposed to go works out way better in the remake, that they just like kind of drift apart, and he's already like moved on by the time she wakes up from her injuries, and she just goes back to living. And yeah, she mentions that she never did marry. She like didn't have time for it, 'cause she was, still probably like trying to run her whole family's farm. Like,
yeah. Well, the thing that we were talking about earlier where she was like most childlike when LaBeouf makes that shot and takes out Ned Pepper right after Tom Chaney like knocks him out and she shoots him. She literally she kills the guy for the first time ever in her life. And you really don't get to you don't really get to feel what she feels from that moment. 'Cause before, she's almost immediately in danger and bit by a rattlesnake. You hear her like hallucinating, and they're riding and she's talking about Tom Chaney and like, we got to get Tom Chaney, and like, he's already dead at this point. So she's going through she's going through a lot of trauma. And when you jump to the like 25 years later, she doesn't have her arm. I don't know how to describe it. She's just like so hardened as a person. I think that's kind of like where the tragedy element comes in. It's like this adventure like essentially ruins her life, and she's not gotten over it.
Yeah.
And I don't know if it's like, I don't know if exactly she doesn't, if she blames or doesn't blame, or 100% how she's feeling towards Rooster's character. 'Cause they do kind of make it out to be like, just timing never worked out, and that's why we never saw each other. And she does essentially hunt him down. Like, she does find out where he's at, and she missed him by, like, a couple days. But, yeah, just, like, who she is as a person, it's like, what do you think that the movie is saying about that? Like, the Downer kind of ending, is it, like, because Rooster, at the time of most of the movie takes place, that's the end of his life. Like, how you said, he already feels that his time has come and gone,
yeah. And
he's pretty much given up. And she's kind of similar, where, like, the greatest moment of her life happened when she was 14.
Yeah.
And now that she's, like, middle-aged, like, life's been kind of a letdown from that point on. She's just there till she goes.
Yeah, that's what it feels like. It's what it seems like they're more going for in that version.
And that's the moment too where she walks away into the snow. And I love the snow in this movie. I like how it's constantly, it just adds that element of, like, the wilderness out there to kill you, and, like, how unsafe it is to be out there. But when she walks away, and I don't know who's singing, I don't know if it's Matt Damon or not, but they sing the Leaning on Everlasting Arms song, and that's what I was saying. That's like she's an amputee now, so is it meant to be funny? Like, it's definitely nodding to the fact that she has no arm. So it's weird to me that it has that religious quote at the beginning of the movie about the wicked flee, but none pursueth. She doesn't necessarily, like, flee, but it has kind of, like, a dark persona to, like, or dark meaning to what's happening, I think, at, like, the end of the movie. But then they bring that song, which is a religious song, and it's, like, now with the context of the missing arm, it's almost like they're mocking the song, kind of. They're using the song for, like, it's not like a laugh out, it's not like Big Lebowski funny, but it's like, hey, did you see what we did? Are you listening to this song here?
Yeah, they like to put their jokes in it when they can get them.
Kicking the kids. When I first saw this movie, I thought that it was great. Then I rewatched the original, and it follows closely, but it's still better.
Yeah, it's still improving.
Maybe one day I'll read the book.
I think it's definitely worth reading. Oh, you know what? There is, I almost forgot, there is one other dude connection in this film. Well, first off, and it is a line, it's a line that's in the original, but it always makes me laugh because his whole thing is the dude abides. And that's what his wife says, however she puts it, like, kindness does not abide in you, is what she tells his character. But also when he talks about living with a Chinaman, and I always just think that's not the proper nomenclature.
Yes.
Chinaman selling me bad shells again.
I'm so glad you brought that up, because I thought that too. It doesn't, like, it feels more like the Big Lebowski in the original True Grit than it does in the remake. But yeah, that line, I'm glad that you brought that up. You got to tie it all together.
Yeah, just like that rug tied that room together.
Now, I'm sure did you watch True Grit on a Blu-ray?
No, it was just on Netflix, so I just randomly put it on Netflix. Half the time, I just end up streaming these movies, even though I own them, just because it's more convenient than me figuring out, well, like, which shelf the movie's on. And like,
so you're admitting that your system's a little flawed there.
I don't have a system. It's alphabetical.
That is a
system. Well, it is a system, but it's a system of no system.
I thought you had things like these were by directors, and I'm like, well, that got to be a hell of a lot harder to find. Like
10 years ago, man, get with the times.
Mine's always been alphabetical. I saw a meme that was like, whenever you can't find the movie that you're looking for on your shelf, and it was this the moment at the end of Scream with Stu, where he's saying, I'm starting to get a little woozy here. And I'm like, I don't have that problem because everything is alphabetized, so I know exactly where it's going to be. That's on the funny shelf. I think I will do a music cue for our next director.
Do it.
That's our music cue. So now you know what
it is. Don't cut that moment if you forget to do it or don't have time. Just leave it in there. Yeah, even if you forget the... Because I could see that being your thing. Like, did you mix that episode? And be like, yeah, I think I remembered everything. And then that's just at the very end and you forgot to put that in. Just dead silence. That's the music cue.
Yeah. So I either gave you a music cue or, fuck you, I didn't give you a music cue at all. We'll
have to see if he has time or remembers.
But we're moving into another director, singular director. Probably mostly or all singular directors from here on out. The Coens are one of the rarities.
Yeah, there's not another directing team that's as prolific. Like, even if we really wanted to, the only other big ones are like the Wachowskis, but their big thing is
the Farrelly brothers.
Yeah, the Farrelly brothers, or they're here and there.
We could do Wachowski. There's enough stuff there. There's a lot of stuff that I haven't seen. I have not seen Cloud Atlas, and I have not seen.
You ever seen Cloud Atlas?
Jupiter Ascending.
I've never seen Jupiter Ascending either, but I like Cloud Atlas. It's a good one.
I heard Cloud's great, and I heard Jupiter is terrible. So I don't know. We could go that route. But anyways, we got through one of four chosen director themes, and we'll be moving into theme number two, director number two, and I'm excited about that. Yeah. The only bad thing is, I think for you, Chuck, that you like to go and try to rewatch all the films, and we have pretty prolific directors where I feel the filmography is pretty dense for each one.
Yeah, it's going to be tough.
There goes all your free time.
It's rough.
I didn't get a lot of Coens in, but we'll see. I still want to do a Raw and Titan double feature. I just got Titan on Blu-ray on Tuesday. Well, when this comes out, it'll be like two Tuesdays ago. So hopefully I will have watched it. But yeah, I mix the podcast and I work all the fucking time. So I'm going to have to watch it this weekend. But that was what my goal was. And seeing the new Scream. My goal was not, let's watch every Coen Brothers movie. Although I do kind of want to watch Intolerable Cruelty to see. I almost think if we ever do another theme, we have to pick that movie.
Yeah, we'll see.
I have to see it again, and like, we have to discuss the worst one. I think when we do a director, we have to pick like not all their prolific ones. We have to, at least one episode has to be based off their worst work. Our favorite, since, you know, we're wrapping up Coens, our favorite Coen Brothers film, No Country for Old Men. I know you like Big Lebowski, but maybe like between the two of us, No Country for Old Men, and the worst, Intolerable Cruelty. I just want to put it on the record. See if we can't do this for every theme. That's our show. We're Cinema D'Amore. Follow us on Twitter at Cinema D'Amore, / Cinema D'Amore on Facebook. On Twitter, I'm at JJMorgan19, Chuck.
66.
And we'll see you next week.
Thanks.
Bye. Thank you.